It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Molforth. The 100th anniversary of the Migratory Bird Treaty is here, and that gives us a chance to talk about birds, always a good idea in the springtime, and to talk about the related issues of conservation and international relations. The amazing flocks of birds that arrive in Alaska in the spring rely on our huge areas of habitat, but they also need habitat down south, where it is much harder to come by, and in less affluent countries, where the fate of wild birds might be less of a priority than it is here. We'll be talking about that, about the treaty, and in the second half of the show, we'll have a fascinating conversation with the pair of young men who came to Alaska with the migrating birds to expand interest in wildlife, for youth, and for Hispanic communities. My first guest today is Tamara Zeller. She's an outreach biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and she's responsible for, I guess, the Alaska part of this big national celebration of the Migratory Bird Treaty. And thanks for being here, Tamara.
Thank you.
So what is, why is this particular, we have many conservation laws. Why is it important, this one's particularly important that we'd be celebrating its anniversary?
Well, the Migratory Bird Treaty is actually the foundation for a lot of our bird conservation efforts. There wasn't much in place until the beginning of the 1900s. And so this act itself is basically mandates bird conservation and helps protect them both nationally and internationally, and it is the foundation for all of our bird conservation efforts now.
And when we think back what was happening a century ago, it's almost inconceivable. I've read about, you know, the San Francisco markets where you'd go to buy a dozen eggs and they'd be like mer eggs or something. It'd be some eggs from an island where they're from a bird that has one egg a year. And here in Alaska, you can see historical pictures of massive amounts of wildlife being slaughtered, not for sport, but for just to fill the stores.
Yeah, essentially what was happening around the late 1800s and early 1900s was mass commercial market hunting is what the term was. And exactly what you're describing, hunters would go out and just shoot birds in flocks, and there would be barrels and stacks of birds. And this was happening all over the U.S. It was unregulated. There was a big feather trade going on. Feathers were all in fashion, and so market hunters would not only shoot birds for food, but they'd also shoot them for the fashion industry. And so you do see those historical photos of just piles and piles and piles of birds at train stations, at stores. And yeah, it's kind of inconceivable now to think of it that way, but that's what was happening, and that's sort of what facilitated the passing of these treaties.
Yeah. So that's like, I mean, on the face of it, that would be unsustainable, but how did that become recognized that there need to be laws? And obviously there need to be international agreements because migratory birds cross borders.
Yeah, I think there were a couple of key folks that started paying attention. One was the wife of a prominent person in Massachusetts, and she actually recognized that all these birds that were being used for feathers were declining, and that sort of was a formation of the Audubon Society. So that was one beginning, but it was just a collective sort of consciousness that started occurring, saying, hey, things are disappearing. One of them was passenger pigeon. That used to be 3 to 5 million birds, billion birds, when the settlers first came to America, and eventually went extinct in 1914. And people were just
shocked.
Yeah, were shocked, and they were recognizing, well, hey, something really needs to happen, and this is, you know, the mass piles of birds, this cannot be sustained. And so they finally recognized that, and there was some momentum, and it wasn't easy, but they got some things passed. And
well, we don't really think of the environmental movement going on during the 19th century, but in fact, you know, the whole sort of Hudson Valley in the East Coast, you know, around New York, was clear cut. There were no trees left, and people, you know, the painters were sort of painting pictures of stumps. And as the progressive movement was getting started, people were realizing, well, this isn't going to work. You know, there's not going to be anything left. But then a lot of those sort of more privileged people from that area came west and said, well, we don't want to repeat it. And some of these laws were passed, which we still fight over today, right? We still have this attitude. Yeah. They don't know what they're talking about. In this case, I think through the migratory birds, everybody kind of supports conserving them. It's become almost inconceivable to do it the way we did it then.
Yeah, I think people would be shocked nowadays to go into a supermarket or, you know, just an outdoor market and see a pile of birds. I mean, I just think we're in a better place mentally for understanding what that means. And so so that is good news. But yeah, mm-hmm. it was.
Was it controversial at the time?
Yeah, definitely. It was not easy. And there's a lot of documentation on game wardens that were, you know, killed over trying to protect birds.
Wow.
Just like nowadays, you know, change doesn't come easy. And so there was a lot of resistance. But luckily we, you know, stayed strong and had that law passed.
Yeah. So the passenger pigeon obviously is a famous example where there were like clouds of birds and then they were hunted to extinction, complete extinction. Are there any species that we're familiar with now that, you know, got driven way down and came back?
Ooh, trying to think.
I'm sorry. I hit you with that one without any preparation. I mean, we can think about like bald eagles, which were almost completely gone from the contiguous lower 48 and are back. They're not migratory, but.
Yeah, definitely. A lot of the raptor species that were exposed to the pesticides. Mm-hmm. And then once we recognized that, they were able to rebound. California condor is another example mm-hmm. that I can't remember how many it got down to, but just a very few birds. And then once they figured out what was actually happening, you know, with ingestion of lead pellets and figured out a way to mitigate that, they're coming back. So there are some success stories and we can do it. We just need to really pay attention and be, you know, willing to change and to you know, recognize that.
So what are the conservation issues facing the major migratory birds that we see in Alaska now? I mean, it seems like one of the major issues for a lot of species is habitat, but it seems like we've got tons of wetlands in Alaska. So what is sort of the issues facing our migratory birds?
Well, habitat's interesting because we think, you know, we always think of our backyard, and Alaska has a lot. But they migrate, like you said, across borders down to the lower 48 where things aren't as uninterrupted. There's a lot of development along the flyway, what we call flyways. So say you have a bird that's coming from California up to Alaska to breed. Well, they go back down to California in the wintertime. They have to be able to sustain themselves by food and have a safe place. And so we might have a lot of great breeding areas and undeveloped land, but they have to be able to sustain themselves in the wintertime. And that's sort of the challenge with any migratory bird, as well as internationally, because we don't have the same laws as like, you know, across the ocean mm-hmm. per se. So they're facing different levels of pollution, different levels of development, you know, in different countries as well. So so habitat sounds like, yeah, they're great in Alaska, but they face those challenges on their migration.
So let's talk about some of the species that face particular challenges. That are sort of Alaska, familiar Alaska species.
I'm thinking of yellow-billed loons, for example. Mm-hmm. People might not be familiar with them as much as the common loon that's more on boreal forest lakes, but yellow-billed loons nest in the Arctic, and they have been found to migrate over to the Yellow Sea, which is highly polluted.
Well, where's the Yellow Sea?
It is in North Korea.
Oh, wow.
Along North Korea, South Korea, that
area. Birds have no idea who's communist and who's
yeah,
not, right?
Yeah, and so they have different laws as far as mm-hmm. pollution and what they can put into their waterways, and then different laws regarding bycatch. Loons are fish eaters, and so they might often get caught in nets. And so that's just an example of it's a really not rare species, but a species with a low population, and so mm-hmm. any impacts can really affect them. So if they're being negatively impacted on their wintering grounds or where they spend the winter months and then come back to Alaska, we're going to see that eventually.
Isn't that cool to think of, like, the waterfowl that we're watching in the summertime have come from all over the place? And I think of, like, geese and ducks and stuff. Of course, they're coming up the West Coast, but hadn't really thought about the fact that it could be coming from Southeast Asia and everywhere.
Yeah, one of the neatest stories I think everybody's familiar with is the Arctic tern that flies all the way from the tip of South America to Alaska every year, round mm-hmm. trip. That's a lot of miles. And
somebody should explain to them that, like, if they go to different hemispheres, they're always going to be there.
Another really cool migrant that flies nonstop is a bar-tailed godwit. They fly all the way from Alaska to New Zealand nonstop.
Incredible.
Yeah, and they have to burn so much body fat and prepare for that. So if they encounter something really like a bad storm or some of, you know, there's during their travels, it's going to really impact them. So we need to pay attention to what's going on.
Well, it just seems almost improbable that an animal could do that. And the, like, who was the first god would have tried it, right?
Yeah,
it just seems
true.
Like, how did it get established? I mean, it's just an incredible journey.
Yeah, it's a mystery with a lot of things with bird behavior, where it originated from and how they know to, at what time of year to go when. And there's all these physical cues from the earth, but still, yeah, who decided to go first?
Yeah,
that's
totally
a good
cool
question.
We're talking about the Migratory Bird Treaty, which is having its 100th anniversary this year, and there's lots of events going on. And my guest is Tamara Zeller, who is an outreach biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So let's talk a little bit about what the centennial actually encompasses. I mean, what's going on?
Okay, yeah, we have we want to recognize this centennial in several different ways. We want to recognize what makes Alaska's story unique, and also just highlight different events and festivals and organizations that do good things for birds. So I've been working with several partners to put together a calendar of events of bird festivals, lecture series, and other projects that highlight that organization's contribution to bird conservation, but also talks about what we can do and what's important. Also working with the Native community to tell the story of the amendment to the treaty. When the treaty was originally signed, it didn't take into account the importance of birds to mm-hmm. Native culture and didn't allow for a subsistence harvest. And in 1997, the treaty was amended to allow for that harvest, a legal spring and summer season mm-hmm. for subsistence for Alaska Natives. So I think that's a really unique
yeah.
part of our history related to this. So I'm trying to
so what kinds of
that.
Events are these? I mean, are you there's the shorebird festivals happen every spring
yep.
right around now in Ketchmack Bay and in Cordova, and are just going to be presenting more talks and stuff in those kinds of situations.
Yeah. Yeah, so for established festivals, we're just going to be, you know, talking a little bit about the history of the treaty. I think people, like you had mentioned, don't really understand how it evolved, like how bird conservation evolved
mm-hmm.
and the story behind it, but also just provide people with ways that they can help even now, like recycling plastic so it doesn't go into our oceans, things like that. And then we have a couple of fun things, like we just had a bird trivia event at the zoo.
Oh, fun.
So it's just a different way of talking about birds.
Uh-huh.
There's going to be a lecture series at the Alaska Public Lands and Information Center starting in June. So that's will be different talks by different biologists and whatnot for just about different bird conservation topics.
Cool.
So those are some examples of what's going on.
So we'll have all of these linked from our website at alaskapublic.org, and you can just click on today's show, Outdoor Explorer, about the Migratory Bird Treaty, or go directly to Alaska, to outdoorexplorer.org, and you'll find it there. So when the treaty first came into being, I imagine it was focused on limiting seasons and limiting takes for hunters, right? Was that the sort of original impetus of what those first conservation laws were?
I think that really ultimately it was to stem the market hunting and just how devastating that was, and to establish what you're talking about, establish a legal season.
Prior to that, it was kind of anything goes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So to make it more sustainable, recognizing people still would like to hunt, but also making it so you're not just, you know, just killing everything and having these huge piles. So it did establish a regular hunting season, mostly for waterfowl species.
And it moved hunting from sort of food gathering to sport to some degree when those laws were coming in that were sort of the Boone and Crockett Club and sort of the Teddy Roosevelt crowd was sort of, they were gentlemen and they sort of had the idea that it was for sport. And they didn't really think too much about Alaska Natives who had subsisted on these animals for a really long time. But I guess it worked out all right for a while because nobody was enforcing the law in Native areas, right? I mean,
yeah, it sort of became, I think, an unsaid understanding, or, you know, an unspoken understanding that this was still occurring. And without this amendment, we were just going to, you know, let it be as it is. But you know, I think the Native community fought really hard to get this amendment established so that they could be legally recognized. And I think it's a really neat achievement and part of our story. So.
Yeah. Yeah. So this protest took place, which I guess was in the early 1970s. I mean, it took quite a while to get the amendment after the protest, which was called the Duck Inn.
The Duck Inn, yeah.
So do you know this whole story of the Duck Inn?
I know a little bit about it. It's funny. I was just talking about this with someone yesterday. Yeah, essentially, it occurred up in Barrow, and some Native Alaskans were hunting, duck hunting, and there was a game warden that had come up or was established there and confiscated their guns because they were illegally hunting. And then it became everybody sort of joined forces between I think it was two gentlemen that were targeted, and they all stood behind him, and it became this big sort of
yeah. Well, I talked to Oliver Levitt, who I guess was a kid at the time, and he told me the story about how everybody got the word, we're all going to go duck hunting, and so everybody killed the duck and brought it to the warden to get cited, to get arrested, so that he would have to cite and arrest everybody in town, which I just thought was such a wonderful story. And it was during that sort of anti-war, you know, counterculture period when people were doing love-ins and whatever inns, and so it was a duck inn.
Yeah, it's an important part of the history, and I think just demonstrates that this amendment was super important, and to recognize how important birds are and hunting to the Native culture. So
something that amazingly had gone like 70 years without being recognized. Mind-boggling, really.
It took a long time. And so I think that's, you know, one of my main goals is to raise awareness about that particular piece of the history of the treaty.
Yeah. So when you go into Native communities, people will talk about hunting birds that we don't normally think of hunting in the sort of sport hunting world, mm-hmm. Including, you know, birds like eiders that are kind of considered to be, you know, in trouble. And I'm just wondering how you, from the Fish and Wildlife Service, are those subsistence hunts, are those a threat to some of those species? Or how is that managed and sort of taken into account?
In several different ways. The different species, it is different for natives. They can shoot different
swans,
loons, anything that has not been formally listed as endangered or threatened, and even with those, there may be a quota, not necessarily for birds, but you know, in the instance of marine mammals. But mm-hmm. what has happened for the birds after the treaty amendment was passed, the Alaska Migratory Bird Co-Management Council was formed, and this is a body that provides suggestions for regulations for that spring summer harvest. So it's a representative of Alaska Natives, Fish and Wildlife and Fish and Game, and there's meetings each spring and fall, and they talk about exactly that, like if there's a concern over a certain species, should they, you know, not hunt it, and different proposals are passed or, you know, examined, and they talk exactly about what you're saying. Mm-hmm. So there's this co-management body formed to do exactly that, is to look at, you know, different species that are being hunted. And
I guess that all has to be coordinated with the other countries if this is an international treaty. I mean, it seems mind-bogglingly complicated to manage these animals that have a huge international range.
Yeah, if there's a particular species that is in question that migrates, there'll definitely be some coordination with those other countries. And the treaty amendment was signed off by Canada and Mexico, and so they agreed to it as well. So there is an understanding, and they also have indigenous populations that use birds as well. So I think the understanding was mutual. But if there is a particular question, you would definitely coordinate as much as possible with those countries.
Mm-hmm. So I know you're a field biologist as well as doing this outreach work, and I'm curious about your interest in these in birds. I mean, are you a bird watcher?
I like birds. I love birds, but I can't say I'm a birder. I don't have a list. Uh-huh. I think I just love them for the behaviors, their existence, their I'm not into writing them down. Life list, but I think they're just magical. I mean, they can fly, they can do things that we wish we could do. They're just every part of our life is touched by a bird, whether you think about it or not. You see them every day. They have a big role in the economy.
And it's so cool when they show up and you see your first, geese and swans and ducks.
They're kind of...
I'm not sort of like a super birder either, but I can recognize enough of them to sort of like, oh, yeah, welcome to Alaska.
Yeah, I think everybody, right when we're in the doldrums of winter and it's got its claws in us, and then you start hearing familiar sounds of birds calling, you're like, oh, spring is finally here.
Yeah.
It kind of does bring some... joy to your day.
I'm curious as to how the timing has been affected by our warming climate. And I don't know, I'm throwing this at you without knowing if this is a topic you know much about, but the shorebirds sort of seem like they come on a really tight schedule. Have some of those things been changing?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think everybody is finally accepting that things have changed. Whether or not it's going to be a permanent pattern, we're not sure. But I can speak for this year. Things are about 2 weeks early, phenology-wise. Birds are arriving like a couple weeks early. And it'll be interesting to see what happens throughout the rest of the year. But as far as arrival times, yeah, there are grebes out on the lakes already calling. I'm not quite sure how that's going to play out as far as how it will impact or not impact populations or whatnot, but yeah.
Well, there was some concern at one time that climate change was going to cause the synchronization of migrations to get out of sync with food supply and predators and prey and so forth. But it seems like our whole ecosystem has changed a couple of weeks, so I'm not sure if that's a problem or not.
Yeah, that's a good point. I was thinking the same thing as far as, well, the birds are here early, but so is their food. If the lake's thawed out, they can get access to it. So, it remains to be seen if there are going to be big shifts in migration patterns, if they're going to be stopping in different areas that they didn't stop before. That gives even greater importance to preserving other parts of the land, in different areas that we might not think about.
So yeah.
It's a story that's unfolding as we speak. So.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, if folks want to learn more about the Migratory Bird Treaty and the centennial that's taking place this year, you go to outdoorexplorer.org, and we'll have a link to the Fish and Wildlife Service where they've got all these events planned. And, thanks very much, Tamara Zeller, for being with us today.
Thank you.
Stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Stay with us. I have a really interesting interview ahead with a pair of Tamara's colleagues, two young Latino men who have traveled to Alaska with the migration, and they're trying to spread the interest in birds to their generation and to their culture. But first, here's a piece I think you'll enjoy from a special series, One Species at a Time, with Ari Daniel Shapiro from the Encyclopedia of Life.
From the Encyclopedia of Life, this is One Species at a Time. I'm Ari Daniel Shapiro. I'm about to tell you a story for your ear, but you should know that you can visit EOL.org and watch this story, too. We made it into a Google Earth tour that lets you follow this journey on a map. Okay, now for the story. Arctic terns, or Sterna paradisea, have stubby legs, so they're clumsy on land. But in the sky, that's a different story.
It's a very elegant bird in the air. It's made for life in the sky.
And, says Karsten Eggevang, a researcher at the Greenland Institute of Natural Resources, Arctic terns put that flying ability to good use.
It conducts this extremely long migration.
A migration from the Arctic to the Antarctic and back every year. Egevang wanted to know more about that journey, how they get from the very north to the very south, and where they stop along the way. So in July of 2007, Egevang headed up to Sand Island off the coast of Greenland. That's where he could find 1,000 breeding pairs of Arctic terns. His plan was to attach little geolocator bracelets to the legs of the birds to log their flight paths. But that was easier said than done.
There was absolutely no protection towards storms, so we had some really, really bad weather where our tents blew into the sea.
Wait, your tents blew into the sea? Didn't you need those tents to sleep?
Yeah, they'll get just devastated by the storms.
And if the cold and wet weren't enough, and the noise, they were also under attack.
The Arctic terns are very good at defending their colony, so they would attack us all the time from behind where you didn't notice them, and pick us in the head with their really pointy beaks.
And yet, despite the frosty elements and getting hammered in the back of the head over and over again by the very birds he was trying to study, Egevang was able to set up a handful of traps.
Trap that we would place over the nest, and once the bird comes back to incubate the eggs, the trap will catch the bird and we're able to handle the bird.
Egevang managed to trap 50 Arctic terns and attach the bracelets to them, and within days the birds took off in small flocks and began their migratory odyssey. To retrieve the data, Egevang had to get those geolocators back, so he waited a whole year for the birds to return. And when they did,
we would look up in the air at several hundred birds at the same time and look for that one bird that would have a small log on the leg. So that was really time consuming.
Egevang would track the bird back to its nest and set up that same trap to retrieve his geolocator.
Well, we are really far away into the Greenland wilderness, so we don't have all that much to celebrate with, apart from a bottle of whiskey. So we had a whiskey when we caught a bird.
All told, he tagged 10 birds and drank 10 shots of whiskey. He expected to find the birds would be in a hurry to get where they were going. But after leaving the breeding grounds, the birds spent a month hanging out in the middle of the North Atlantic.
This was completely unknown that the birds would do that.
Most of what's driving their migratory path is food, so they hang around spots where there are lots of small fish to eat. They start flying south again in September.
And then something really surprising happening around equator.
There's a migratory divide, a split.
About half the bird would follow the coast of Africa, whereas the other half would cross the Atlantic and then follow the coast of South America. But all of them came back to spend the winter in the Weddell Sea down at Antarctica, where they will find an iceberg and rest and just fish and eat.
From November to April. And then within a week, all the birds take off to begin their northward return flight.
Instead of following the same routes as they did when they migrated south, they would pick a totally different S-shaped pattern, flying towards Africa, crossing the equator, and then reaching almost as far as the Caribbeans before they would start flying towards Greenland.
The birds were able to take advantage of a strong tailwind, so they covered a lot of ground, over 300 miles per day.
It's like the birds were in a hurry to get back to the breeding grounds, and they more or less just went as fast as they could.
He can say something now about hotspots in the ocean, places that are especially rich in food, not just for Arctic terns, but for other seabirds and marine mammals, too. That can be helpful in deciding which parts of the ocean require extra conservation attention. And Egevang has calculated that all the flying an Arctic tern does during its life,
it's equal to if the Arctic terns were to fly to the moon and back three times. That's really amazing if you look at it that way.
What's amazing to me is that the birds, they really have to be adapted to the whole globe.
That's true.
So do you have new respect for these birds after seeing the results?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they are really, really tough small birds.
And because of where Arctic terns spend their time, says Egevang, in a year they not only see more of our planet, but also more daylight than any other creature on Earth. Don't forget to visit EOL.org, where you can find a Google Earth tour of our story. It's got images and videos of the terns and animations of their flight paths driven by Egevang's data. Our series, One Species at a Time, is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. I'm Ari Daniel Shapiro.
We're We're back. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and today we are talking about migratory birds. It's the 100th anniversary of a major treaty that takes care of our birds and makes sure that they're okay, and there's a celebration going on. And so we were talking about that in the first half, and now I've got a couple of young men in the studio who have just arrived in Anchorage as we're talking. They somehow landed what sounds like the coolest job that I've ever heard of. Christian McWilliams, who is a recent graduate of George Mason University. He's from Norfolk, Virginia. And Jean Rodriguez, who is from Puerto Rico, a graduate of the University of Puerto Rico and is a microbiologist. And they have been following the migration of the birds as they head up the west coast towards Alaska. And I guess I'd have to start out, Christian, tell me, like, how did you land this job? Who asked you to do this?
So my background so far has been in a lot of communications work for conservation NGOs. And I applied for a position with Environment for the Americas in D.C., actually. And sometimes I joke that I think I just checked the box that I was interested in Alaska. It was on the form. But they called me 2 days later and was like, actually, we've got another project we're really considering. And I think because they want this project to be bilingual, because they want people who don't really have a strong birding background but a good conservation background, I ended up getting picked. And I think on one hand, a lot of luck, and another hand, just being in the right place.
So part of this is trying to spread out birding and appreciation for these birds to a broader population, rather than the sort of the narrow, relatively narrow world that is interested now. Is that right?
Yeah, because, I mean, a lot of the people, if you speak to birders or people involved with the research, they know very well the problems that are facing birds and like loss of habitat and infrastructure in their way. But if you speak to the average person, even myself 4 or 5 months ago, I would not have been able to go in detail about what are facing birds right now. And, you know, their populations are dropping pretty dramatically in some cases.
Yeah. So, Jean, tell me how you guys have, what's been the process that you're following to make this happen or to spread the word?
Well, we've been traveling all the way from San Diego up to here to Alaska. We started driving from San Diego to Washington and then flew here in Alaska. And along the way, we've been, as Christian said, meeting a lot of scientists and staying with Bird Observatory, learning a lot about their conservation efforts, their research, and all the issues that migratory birds are facing. So we're blogging in our webpage, which is birdtroopers.com, in both English and Spanish, trying to translate all that information that it's in a scientific language. We're translating it into a more broader and digestible language. So yeah, we're also using our social media like Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter to let people know where we are and what we're doing.
So we'll make sure to put a link to your blog on our website at outdoorexplorer.org, and people can check that out. So you're talking about the kind of the demographics of birding a little bit, and it sounds like you guys aren't necessarily, I mean, you were a birder before, right, John?
Well, I wasn't a birder myself before. I started working a lot in forestry. So whenever I was in the forest, I liked to watch the birds and try to identify it. I've never been a birder for like a professional thing. Mm-hmm. So this is my first time. But we figured out that most of a bird culture, it's not very enjoyable for our young generation. And we're trying to put a new face to this birding culture, trying to relate younger people and people that it's not that didn't grew up really connected to nature. So yeah, we're really trying hard.
Yeah. So what is that? Let's draw the stereotypical birder. You know, it's probably somebody more my age, a middle-aged person with a slightly nerdy, like with a shirt with lots of pockets
and really expensive binoculars and retired and has lots of free time. And it's, but at the end of the day, like birding has, and I know I'll never be able to go anywhere without asking myself like, oh, what are those birds there? Because it really adds another layer to every forest, every park you go to be able to check out birds that are there in their natural habitat or migrating.
Yeah,
absolutely. Your typical birder is sort of someone who's just got their free time because they've they're living a rich retired life and they just want to hang out and have a good, you know, it's very different, I think, from the demographic that I think could really enjoy birding. It's a fun experience.
Yeah. So tell me about the language barrier. How does language fit into this? John, do you want to take that?
Language, you mean?
In
like
other words, Spanish versus English, and how you know the Hispanic community is maybe excluded from some of this.
Yeah, along our way, we've met so few Hispanic birders. Just maybe three or four. Last week, we met a family that was with us in the boat, but yeah, mostly we've like. Sometimes the Hispanic community or other communities that are not like English speaking are not introduced to birding for many reasons. But
what do you guys think is the reason for that? I mean, is this a cultural thing?
I mean, if you look at the kind of places birders go to or the kind of places anyone goes out recreationally, you've got a bunch of signage that's all in English that can be really difficult to break into. And I think we live in an era where it could be really easy to adapt and have sort of a QR code or something that I could scan with my phone, and now I've got every language I can think of.
Yeah.
And little things like that would make parks more accessible. But at the end of the day, you've got huge classes of people who I think Jean and I are sort of the exception. If you grew up in a home that was struggling, camping's an expensive thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that already puts you in a position to not really have a likelihood of having a connection to the outdoors, let alone birding. So little things like that, I think there are huge groups of people that could really enjoy going outside and having a great experience with birds that in many ways is a very cheap experience because most parks are free, but you see it, you show up to it, it looks like a place that might cost you a lot. It's got a lot of signs in English that you may not understand. It's got a lot of professional staff in uniform that kind of look like police officers.
Yeah,
times.
Right.
Like it's sort of it can be, especially if you don't know the language, if you're not from the culture, yeah. It can be very difficult to penetrate into.
Yeah, I think that's such an interesting point, yeah.
Sometimes they're not very well developed for families, like at least our Latinos are, we have really big families and we want to go everywhere with them. So whenever you go to the refuge or to some parks, like there's not places where you can enjoy being with your family.
Kind of really like, spread out, yeah.
Yeah, it's like really spread out and people want everything to be so calmed and we need to diversify this culture of.
This is so interesting because, you know, Anchorage prides itself on being very culturally diverse, you know, with 100 languages in the schools and just high percentages of minorities. But in the outdoor community, it really isn't. I mean, if you go to our ski races or you go to our national parks, you pretty much see, sort of white middle class population.
Yeah.
And what you say about like sort of this sense like, oh, well, the campground has to be totally quiet and all that sort of, and you don't think about that as being a cultural value, but it obviously is, right? That's just the way we do it because that's the way we do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there are some places where it's important to be quiet just because for the wildlife's sake, but there are other places where that's not the case at all. And like even the zoo we were just at for rehabilitating animals that uses them as an educational purpose, like being quiet there is really not that big a deal. You can go there with your family, and they're doing a really good job reaching out to a lot of different schools and a lot of different people. But think about like when you get into anything, whether it be some gaming or some sport, you get into it because people you know do it, and then you connect with them and you move forward and you start enjoying it. You tell other people about it. If you are two handshakes away, you may not actually get that handshake that gets you to go to the park with someone because no one in your group of friends does that. Mm-hmm. So I think language is the biggest thing.
Yeah, the language and sort of what you grew up with, and you have to sort of make an effort to spread this out to other kinds of people.
Sometimes the kids speak English and the parents don't. So you find the kids translating everything to their parents. And I guess that's something that constrains many families to go.
Sure.
If you have people like staff that also speak Spanish, you can just show them around in Spanish, and I think that will kind of bring more people and diversify.
Well, I think it's great that Fish and Wildlife Service is actually making a point of reaching out and has brought you guys in. I guess is it sort of an internship position?
Yeah,
more or less. To do this, knowing that they couldn't do it themselves, they needed you to do it.
In a lot of ways, it's really interesting to be able to produce material that my mother can read. That like. At the end of the day, the fact that I'm just reaching her and then my family on top of that just shows me that what I'm doing works really well. Because I know there's tons of people that read our blog or that read our social media posts and are seeing a topic discussed in a language that, when you Fish and Wildlife Service, most people in that group are white, older, and sort of, I mean, they are doing a really good job diversifying their employment, mm-hmm. which really helps them connect with a large group of people. But in the day, I think we provide an angle that maybe you can't get from most people.
Yeah, it's a great idea. So we're talking about the migratory birds today. It sounds like we're talking about race and culture, but the two kind of go together because my two guests, Christian McWilliams and John Rodriguez, are on a journey to follow the West Coast migration that is just ending up here in Alaska right now, and at the same time, kind of proselytizing for bird watching and for the natural world among many kinds of people, and blogging in English and in Spanish as they go. So, where did the journey begin, John? You want to sort of give us the story about like where you started and what your mode of transportation has been?
Well, yeah, we started in San Diego. The first week was basically an intense training on bird identification, mostly shorebirds.
Oh wow! So you show up, okay?
Yeah. So yeah. Like after that week, we feel like birders ourselves. Yeah. So it's been really great. And we drove all the way from San Diego to Washington, stopping at the different refuge and observatories.
So you had like an itinerary stopping at each Fish and Wildlife Service site?
Yeah, we had our contacts in the different refuge along the way. Mm-hmm. So we were meeting them and they were showing us around and explaining us about all the efforts they've done and keep doing. Mm-hmm. Then we met our counterpart in Canada from Environment of Canada. And they have other two interns that are basically doing the same thing as we're doing, but in British Columbia. So we kind of drove with them around British Columbia a little bit, learning about their part of their conservation and their cool. different approach.
Were they like you? I mean, a similar pair of people?
Yeah, they're basically our same age, and they've been doing also a really great job blogging and taking a lot of pictures and doing really cool stuff. So then we flew to Juneau. We spent there like 4 days or so, and now we're here in Anchorage.
All right.
Yeah, and we have a car now, and we're going to be driving all the way to Fairbanks and Denali and back to Anchorage and then to Homer. So
when you go, have you been going along at sort of the same pace as the migration, Christian? Have you sort of been seeing the birds as they move their way north?
Yeah, so we haven't been following any particular group of birds, but it's been really interesting over the last 3 months being able to see, I don't know, a black-bellied plover in San Diego, that you look at it and you ask yourself, why is that called a black-bellied plover? It's not black at all. But then as we've been moving north, you see birds like that slowly changing their plumage. And even now when we see them, I don't think we've seen any in Alaska yet.
No.
If they come to Alaska, actually.
You kind of leapfrogged. You took an airplane.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, you're going 500 miles an hour, so they couldn't keep up with you.
We've seen huge groups of cranes, huge groups of geese. Yeah. It's been really interesting to see eagles change their behavior, even if they're residents or if they're, because in some places they're feeding on, you know, what you would expect them, sort of swooping down and stuff, but in other places they're just looking for dying geese and they're just sort of being advantageous in that moment, and they're only doing it because the geese happen to be here for this week and a half.
So the migration in each particular spot is pretty brief then, huh, in terms of when they arrive and when they leave?
Yeah, I mean, birds sort of, like, depending on the species, they'll land at different times. They'll take off for different distances. So you can be in one location and not, I think a few spots we've been there, just no birds are there. An occasional speck of birds. And like, oh, you guys missed them. They were here a couple days ago.
Oh, wow.
And like, but if we wait a day, we might get this species coming in now. And so things like that. Yeah.
So what are these sites like that you're visiting? I mean, are they like wetlands just along the...
Yeah, like every kind of habitat that birds would like, and they need to stop to feed on and have some fat and like keep going. Mostly wetlands along California, and a lot of rivers also. We've been in Washington.
So, have you noticed some of the habitat challenges or issues in different areas and how those differ?
In California, they're dealing a lot with the drought that they're facing.
Oh,
they've
yeah.
been facing a couple of years now. So they have like a big staff trying to manage all the wetlands, importing water from different places just to fill up the ponds. Sometimes they don't have the water to fill up the ponds, so like some ponds are just left dry. And also development, like we've seen a lot of refuges that are just in the border of the development, like in San Francisco and many other, like, mostly cities. So that's a huge part of, like, what's one of the main issues that birds are facing
being,
right now.
Being basically encroached in smaller and smaller areas of habitat. Yeah,
and those are places that they used to fly around, and now they don't have those places to fly around, and they find themselves caught up in cities where they have, like, big buildings that are totally reflective from the reflecting the sky and the trees. So they've been facing a lot of strikes on the buildings also.
Mm. That's an interesting perspective from here in Alaska, because, you know, we have so much undisturbed habitat, but that's not enough. If they don't have the habitat down south, that they, it has to be a complete connection. Mm. Right,
that's exactly the point of the treaty. There's so many nations, you know, south of our border. Like, Mexico's included as a part of the treaty, but if you go into further into Latin America, Central America, South America, like, you've got a lot of places that are making efforts, maybe aren't a part of the treaty, but you've got a lot of places that aren't making the right efforts. And but that could be for various issues they have there. Say you've got farmers who are really dependent on growing the right crops and are using a certain type of pesticide, and it's going to be very difficult to convince them, hey, I need you to stop using this, when they're trying to make enough money to feed their families. And but getting that conversation to a broader market, getting more people and more nations involved in that conversation to say, you know, this subspecies lands in your nation for X amount of days, and it's that subspecies of these seven species of the same bird that is the one that's dropping off. Perhaps something is happening here. When it's there for 2 days, it's coming in contact with something. Maybe it's not finding food it needs. Maybe it just can't find water. So it's these guys run an ecosystem that covers an entire hemisphere.
Yeah. So, Christian, you studied international conflict analysis at George Mason, and with an emphasis on environmental issues, which is kind of the biggest topic in the world right now. We're dealing with climate change and everything else, and it seems like one of the challenges there has been between wealthier countries and less wealthy countries. It's much easier for the United States to set aside resources than it is a developing country. Have you sort of studied how that gets resolved, how we sort of bridge those gaps?
Yeah, I mean, I spent a considerable amount of time in India, and it was the first time I was really faced with seeing the challenges that face a nation that is rapidly developing. And when you speak to someone there about the troubles of, like, oh, when you guys do it this way, you're polluting X amount, blah, 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 they'll tell you, well, the U.S. got to do it, why can't we do it? I think it's really unfair of you to tell me that I can't have my economy grow rapidly when the only reason you're here as an educated student is because your country did. And, you know, those are moments where you stop and think, you're right. Like, it, and unless nations like the U.S. and developed nations are going to invest the money and efforts to help them grow just as quickly or in a way that is appealing to that population, they're not going to stop with something that's going to help them feed their families better. Like, when, if you talk to the average person, they're going to say, like, I want this job to do X thing so that I can live a better life. And they're not going to listen to you when you tell them, this is a global problem. We're not going to have air to breathe and crops to grow if we don't solve this. And if we truly believe it's a global problem, we need to be able to step in and invest and form a relationship that we expect. Because there's the worries that money won't be treated properly. So it's a tough agreement between nations to trust each other and say, if we invest this much, will you use it in a way that meets that investment expectation?
Right. And also, we've learned that just handing out money doesn't seem to work very well in international development. Yeah. Wow, it's such an interesting topic. You are studying environmental issues as well, John. And where are you going with them?
I'm more focused on research, environmental research. I studied microbiology in the University of Puerto Rico, and my work was mostly in forestry, so now I'm going to go to grad school in Canada and basically combine the two fields, microbiology and forestry, working with the whitebark pine and mountain pine beetle issue, but trying to improve the seedlings through the mycorrhizal fungi and natural infecting bacteria. Mostly conservation efforts, and I mean, I want to keep doing research that can be implemented into policy, because, like, sometimes research it's just a piece of paper that no one is using. So I want to do something that can be used on a local or global scale to be implemented and be useful.
You know, stereotypes about generations are always pretty slippery, right? Because there may be many more individuals with many more different outlooks from different generations. But I feel like your generation is one that is much more focused on sort of environmental issues and some of and devoting your life to improving things in a way that others weren't. I don't know. Would you buy that, Sean?
Yeah, totally. I think right now we're seeing the results of all the climate change issues, and it's something that it's actually affecting us. It's not just some random theory anymore. It's something mm-hmm. that it's affecting a lot of amount of people, even us, in different ways here in Alaska. Glaciers are melting, and sea level is rising everywhere in the world. So it's something that, like, once you see the real changes, that's when people get more interested and start working towards conservation. So I think
it's happening. I think it really is happening. It's kind of hopeful in that way, mm-hmm. is that people care. That's that's step one. So I've got two guests with me today for Outdoor Explorer. John Rodriguez was just speaking, and Christian McWilliams. They're recent college graduates, interns, who've done this journey up the West Coast following the migration of the waterfowl coming to Alaska. And have done that for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, partly to create outreach to younger people and to people from different cultural backgrounds to spread the love of wildlife and the love of birds beyond kind of the traditional white middle class group that is so much a part of our outdoor world. Sometimes we even forget that's the case. So you guys started this road trip, and you started in San Diego, and you got training in bird watching. And I can just imagine that situation, thinking, boy, I hope I like this guy, because this could really be a bummer if I don't, right?
Yeah, we actually met in the airport. Sometimes I joke they probably ran us through like a university dorm program or something, because they did ask a lot of weird questions during the interview.
Oh, did they really?
But I think we do really well. And I mean, our Spanish is really similar in that, like, I'm from an Andalusian pocket of Spain, and that Spanish has influenced Puerto Rican Spanish heavily.
Oh, really?
So
interesting.
I think we communicate in a very interesting way in a Spanglish, and I think we solve problems really well. Yeah. But yeah, I think we do a good job. And, we both really care about the same issues.
Yeah, totally.
So you guys mostly speak Spanish in the car, or a combination, or what?
It kind of mixes
Spanglish,
up.
Yeah. Sometimes we speak Spanish and sometimes English. I don't know what's, like, basically triggering the when we speak one or the other language.
Yeah, I'm still trying to determine what topics pull out Spanish and what topics pull out English, And so there are moments we slip into it with other people, and I feel bad because I'm like, oh, they don't think we're talking about them. I'm like, no, we're just...
And so you go to these bird watching sites, and the people there who are doing the bird watching don't look much like you, right? Do you find they're mostly friendly, interested? What's the reaction you get?
Yeah, I think people, it's been really welcoming all the way. They also they know that's the case. Like, they have a certain demography in their groups, and like Audubon and U.S. Fish and Wildlife, they notice it. So I think they're really welcoming, and they really want to diversify their group. So everyone, it's been hosting us and taking us around, and we've been meeting a lot of people. So
it's been a pretty fun trip. What are some of your favorite experiences or things that have happened? Or least favorite, if you've had any disasters.
I think a good, like, recent big favorite was just laughing hysterically in Juneau. We'd been there all of, I don't know, 8 hours, 9 hours, and we saw a bear in our first glacier. It's like, that was my first bear. I don't know about you, but so it was just, Alaska living up to its name. Here I am.
Yeah,
just got here. Here's a bear.
That's our selling point.
Yeah.
That's where we make the big bucks with the tourists.
Not even the staff could, like, really believe that was happening, because it's not a place where birds are usually hanging out.
Yeah.
So.
We were at a visitor center at the time. Yeah.
I guess you guys had a good juju.
We've had good luck this whole trip. Everywhere we go. I remember when the one time we've had bad luck where it rained, we got rained out in California. We feel bad saying anything because California really needs rain, so we're not going to complain about the fact that it's raining.
So do you see yourselves as bird watchers who are going to have lists and buy big binoculars and study books, or how do you see this working into your life in the future?
I'm not a lister. Like, I think I go through my field book and I kind of mark all the birds I've seen along the way, but I don't have like a list with specific sites and everything and the hour and like the habitat and everything. But yeah, like, I see myself keep going on, like, now I carry my binoculars everywhere we go. Like, like, we don't go out of a wherever we're staying if we don't have our binocs. But we're definitely falling into the bird
Yeah,
it's community, and it's been really great. I love
so
it.
What are some of the more interesting things you've seen in terms of birds? I mean, have you seen some like gorgeous flocks of birds? Or
yeah, huge flocks of sandhill cranes.
Oh, wow.
I didn't realize how loud they could be.
They're big and they're loud, right?
Yeah, yeah. If we were 2 miles off, and I remember thinking, like, what's that noise? And they're like, oh, those are the birds. And they're just this deafening sound getting louder and louder as we're walking closer.
Where was that?
That was in Columbia National Wildlife Refuge.
Yeah. It was in eastern Washington. They have like the most bizarre call ever. Like they're so prehistoric and big and weird. And
resonant sound, yeah.
Yeah,
Really we see them all summer up here. They'll, you know, we can even see them in Anchorage on, on our coastal trail.
Yeah, we're hoping to spot some up here. It'd be really cool.
So do you think this is a good vacation? I mean, would you recommend somebody like just do this for... just even though they're not being paid, obviously, and just getting to work their way up the coast?
Well, I certainly won't be able to go on a vacation ever again in my life without asking, or will there be any good birds there? Because it really does add something to... we went on that climb of Mount Roberts recently, and the climb, as much as the birds I saw when I got to the top or to a location, were super exciting. It's kind of like a peak of a mountain. Like, it's less about being up at the very top or finding that bird, but the whole experience of trying to spot one and going out with your friends and having a good time.
I think that's totally true, is that knowing what you're looking at and sort of picking, sort of having the name for it kind of makes the whole landscape much more vivid. I mean, you start to see things differently than you did before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's something I totally recommend people do, like just follow the migration and feel like a bird.
So Puerto Rico is so different from Alaska.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I would think your bird watching there would put our bird watching to shame.
Well, yeah, not much. Like, you receive the whole big flocks all the way here. Mm-hmm. Like, we don't receive that many birds.
Yeah.
Like, as an island in the Caribbean, we have a lot of endemism. So I think it's kind of different. We don't receive that many, like, the huge number of flocks. But we do have, like, our own birds that are, like, really cool. And, yeah, it's a tropical island with a lot of migrant habitats where you can go from the tropical rainforest to the dry forest in a couple hours, and you can see totally different type of birds in both places.
Cool.
So
it's sort of like Alaska, and it's sort of a national afterthought, right?
Yeah.
People don't think of it as being part of America.
Yeah.
Well, thanks both of you for being here. Jean Rodriguez, he's from Puerto Rico, and he's a microbiologist. He's headed off to graduate school this fall, right?
Yeah. I'm going to be studying forest biology management in University of Alberta in Edmonton. So
cool. And Christian McWilliams, he's a graduated George Mason studying international conflict analysis. He's from Norfolk, Virginia, and you're still deciding what you're going
to
do.
Yeah, I'm trying to find a good master's program. I'm getting ready to take the GRE soon, and basically that's where I find myself. Yeah.
Great.
Good luck.
Well, thanks to both of you. Thanks to both of you for being here. That's all for today's edition of Outdoor Explorer. Our producer is Eric Bork. Grace Bojean arranges our guests. My name is Charles Walforth. Be with us again next week, and I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.